Joshua, it's a pleasure to have you join us. Welcome to Dakota Midday.
Well, nice to be here.
Now, to gain some background on the act of killing, would you take us back a few years when you were working on an earlier film and how you learned about the massacres that happened in Indonesia in the mid-1960s?
I first went to Indonesia in 2001 to help a group of plantation workers, oil palm plantation workers, make a film documenting and dramatizing their struggle to organize a union in the aftermath of the Suharto dictatorship, under which unions were illegal. And I found very quickly that the biggest obstacle the workers faced to organizing a union was fear, because their parents and grandparents had been in a strong plantation workers' union until 1965 and had been accused of being potential communist sympathizers simply for being in the union, and were placed in concentration camps and then killed. And the workers were afraid this could happen to them again. After we made the first film, which documented pretty horrific conditions, women workers being forced to spray a herbicide with no protective clothing and the mist getting into their lungs and then their bloodstreams and then gradually dissolving their liver tissue and killing the women in their 40s. After we made that film, they said, come back and let's make another film about the real reason we're dying here, which is fear. Why are we afraid? What is it like for us to live with the perpetrators all around us and still in positions of power? I went back immediately to do that in early 2003, but the army soon threatened the survivors not to participate in the film. The survivors then said, okay, before you quit and go home, try to film the perpetrators. See if they'll tell you how our relatives were murdered. And I was afraid to do so at first, but found to my horror that every single one of them was immediately boastful about the worst details of the killing. My attempt to understand why are they boasting, for whom are they boasting, what happens when killers win and impose their victor's history on a whole society, what does that do to the society? That's the act of killing.
Sure. Now, back in 1965, why was it that this military coup targeted the Indonesian Communist Party, or the PKI? Why were they a target at that time?
Well, there was a rivalry between the Indonesian military and the left. After the left was at the center of the Indonesian Revolution, which ended Dutch colonialism and saw Indonesia become an independent country, and the left was eager for the plantations and the oil fields that the Dutch had exploited and enriched themselves through to be used to benefit to develop the country and to relieve the terrible poverty across the country. They were organized in the largest and legal political party in Indonesia was the Communist Party. It was a party dedicated to participating in government through elections. It was not a revolutionary Communist Party in the sense that they did not espouse violent revolution. And the army saw themselves as the inheritors of the Dutch colonial position and wanted to take ownership of the plantations themselves. And so there was a standoff between the army and the left. This was at the height of the Cold War, and America was eager to crush anything that they perceived as communism, and also to give, and most importantly, I think, to give American companies access to Indonesian resources. America supported the Indonesian army in overthrowing the Sukarno government and in then targeting everybody who was a potential, anybody who was opposed to the new military regime was accused of being a communist and killed. And within 6 months, somewhere between 500,000 and 2.5 million people were killed.
Can you describe, first of all, were there other Western countries that also supported the military? And can you describe the types of aid that came from the West?
Absolutely. The British government was supportive. The Australian government was supportive. The Japanese government was supportive. The U.S. government provided weapons and radios and money and training during the genocide to groups that were being groomed to attack opponents of the new military regime. And the U.S. also provided, one man went to, U.S. State Department officials provided lists of thousands of names of Indonesian public figures who were opposed to the new military government, and potentially sympathetic to the communists, gave these lists and asked the new military regime to hunt down, capture, and kill everyone on those lists. So they gave death lists to the Indonesian government. The core, the perhaps the most important details of how America participated in the genocide remain classified, and clearly we cannot have an ethical relationship with Indonesia going forward unless we acknowledge our own role in these crimes.
We get to know Anwar Kongo in the act of killing, and he was a leader of the Frog Squad in North Sumatra. Can you describe how you began to meet Anwar and other military leaders? You already talked about, you know, how they were boastful of some of the things they did back in the mid-1960s. And even in reenacting some of these events, they do it even with a smile on their face.
I began working with survivors, and when the army threatened them not to participate in the film, the survivors said, okay, Joshua, try to film the perpetrators. I was afraid to approach them, but started with my next-door neighbor in this small plantation village where I was working and found him immediately open to discussing the worst details of the killings, which he would do with a smile on his face and in front of his 10-year-old granddaughter. And after I showed that material to the survivors, they said, keep filming the perpetrators, because anybody who sees this anywhere in the world will be forced to acknowledge that there's something terribly wrong here. They'll be forced to acknowledge, just from the way that these men are speaking about something so awful, that there's an awful impunity. And I then felt entrusted, if you like, by the survivors and the Indonesian human rights community to do a work that they clearly could not do themselves. I spent 2 years, from 2003 to 2005, filming every perpetrator I could find, asking them to introduce me to their fellow death squad members or their commanders. And everyone was boastful, everyone was open, and usually they would invite me to the places they killed, launch into spontaneous demonstrations of how they killed, complain if they hadn't thought to bring along, for example, a friend to play a victim or a weapon to use as a prop, a machete, for example. Mm-hmm. And I started to wonder, how do these men want to be seen? How do they think I see them? How do they want you to see them through my camera? And how do they really see themselves? So I started to propose to them, look, you've participated in one of the biggest killings in human history. I want to know what it means to you and to your society. You want to show me what you've done. So go ahead and show me what you've done in whatever way you wish. I will film your reenactments, but I will also film you and your fellow death squad members discussing what you want to show, and just as importantly, what you want to leave out, in order to document how you want to be seen and how you see yourself, in order to understand what this event means to you and to your society. And that's what I did. So it was a process of simply approaching people, and they were all eager to speak.
It appeared that how they appear to themselves is very important, because some of them really acted with a great deal of vanity. Anwar, Herman Kota, and other paramilitary leaders often refer to themselves as gangsters in the act of killing, and it looks like it comes from their affection of American movies with stars like Marlon Brando and Al Pacino. Was this an attitude that led to the way in which they killed, or was this something that they latched onto as they became more powerful?
It turned out in Medan, in the city where I made the act of killing, that the army, when I reached I started, as I said, in the countryside around Medan, but when I reached the city, I discovered a kind of something serendipitous and absurd and surreal, which was that the army had recruited their killers from people, self-described movie theater gangsters, men who hung out in cinemas, selling movie tickets on the black market, while using the cinemas as a base for much more serious crime as well. And there was a broad left-wing boycott of American movies at the time, because the head of the American Motion Picture Association in Indonesia at the time had been outed, if you like, or exposed for being a CIA agent involved with a plot to overthrow and execute President Sukarno. And so there was naturally a patriotic backlash against Hollywood, this meant that there was a natural antipathy from the movie theater gangsters who profited from selling Hollywood tickets to Hollywood movies and who loved Hollywood movies. There was a natural antipathy between them and the Indonesian left. And so they found, the army found in the movie theater gangsters men who had a proven track record of violence, a capacity for violence, a willingness to be violent, and a hatred of the left, recruited them to do their dirty work. And we hear in the movie, and I just heard again and again from the perpetrators that they would get their methods, they would get ideas for how to kill. And in the case of Anwar, the film's main character, how to kill relatively bloodlessly from watching American movies. And more to the point, Anwar got a way of behaving or acting that allowed him to somehow distance himself from killing, from the act of killing while he was killing. He describes coming out of a gangster, out of an Elvis Presley musical, intoxicated by his love of Elvis, dancing away his way across the street in a cheerful mood and killing happily. Somehow acting, it turns out, was always part of the act of killing for Anwar Kongo.
The Panka Sila Youth are also a group that is predominant in your film, The Act of Killing. They freely discuss rape, torture, and killing. How powerful was this group, and what is the age range of its members?
Panka Sila Youth in Indonesia, in the context of paramilitary movements, can be anything from the age of 15 up to 75.
Okay.
So some of the members were, many of its leaders were killers and death squad leaders at the time of the genocide, while others are young thugs getting a start in Indonesia's paramilitary criminal underground.
There's another scene, getting back to Anwar here, with his grandsons, and he's teaching them compassion as they deal with an injured duck, even telling them to apologize to the duck. And he seems to react emotionally to seeing how children are affected by the violent reenactments. Did you see that side of Anwar before this project, or did it begin to occur as he began to see his past from a different point of view?
If I went looking for monsters when the survivors said, go and meet the perpetrators, I invariably found human beings. Mm-hmm. And the film is a response to that terrible, strange truth, which is that everybody who's ever committed evil in our history is just a human being. And Anwar gradually over the course of the production started to open up about his nightmares. And clearly I became aware quite early that Anwar was not doing this just out of vanity and to glorify himself. He was doing this because somehow he found in me someone who would listen to his story and take seriously his pain.
Mm-hmm.
And so those kind of cracks, if you like, in the facade appeared more and more frequently over the course of the production until they completely overwhelm him by the film's end.
Yeah. I don't want to give away the last few minutes of the film, but I think one of the most powerful scenes in The Act of Killing is after his grandsons begin to watch a scene of him, a reenactment scene in which he has the wire around his neck and is going to be killed. And then you have a conversation with Anwar after that, really powerful scene and somewhat of a surreal moment. And I think there were a lot of surreal moments in this film. Did you kind of have that feeling while you were working on this project?
Audience members have often said to me that their jaw is on the floor from the moment
yeah.
the film begins to the end. I think my jaw was on the floor for 5 years while
wow.
shooting the film. Not because their reactions, not because the surreal boasting and glee with which they would talk about the killings continued to shock me. It didn't. But the contortions to which any human being will go in order to avoid seeing himself as evil, that was astonishing to me. I think there's a moment, there's a It was astonishing, and it was painful, it was frightening, and it was beautiful. And I hope the film is all of those things. to you as well.
I know you have to run here, and we want to thank you for joining us on Dakota Midday. Just one more quick question. You've been working on a companion piece to The Act of Killing that's due next year. Are you able to give us any kind of a quick preview on that?
Absolutely. I'm speaking to you now from New York, where we are having the New York premiere tonight of the new film at the New York Film Festival. It's called The Look of Silence. It's a film about a family of survivors who find out how their son was murdered through the through the footage I was shooting with the perpetrators, and the youngest brother in this family decides to go and confront the men who killed his brother. It's something unprecedented, I think, in the history of cinema or nonfiction cinema, to see a survivor confront a perpetrator in a context where the perpetrators are still completely in power. It's called The Look of Silence, and it'll be in cinemas in the United States from next summer.
All right. And we've been talking with Joshua Oppenheimer about The Act of Killing. And Joshua, we would like to thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you so much for having me on the show.